Chapter 2. A man may have no bad habits and have worse. Pudd'nhead Wilson's New Calendar. The starting point of this lecturing trip around the world was Paris, where we had been living a year or two. We sailed for America, and there made certain preparations. This took but little time. Two members of my family elected to go with me. Also a carbuncle. The dictionary says a carbuncle is a kind of jewel. Humor is out of place in a dictionary. We started westward from New York in midsummer, with Major Pond to manage the platform business as far as the Pacific. It was warm work, all the way, and the last fortnight of it was suffocatingly smoky, for in Oregon and Columbia the forest fires were raging. We had an added week of smoke at the seaboard, where we were obliged to while for our ship. S.E. had been getting herself ashore in the smoke, and S.E. had to be docked and repaired. We sailed at last, and so ended a snail-paced march across the continent, which had lasted 40 days. We moved westward about mid-afternoon over a rippled and summer sea, an enticing sea, a clean and cool sea, and apparently a welcome sea to all on board. It certainly was to the distressful dustings and smokings and swelterings of the past weeks. The voyage would furnish a 3 weeks holiday, with hardly a break in it. We had the whole Pacific Ocean in front of us, with nothing to do, but do nothing and be comfortable. The city of Victoria was twinkling dim in the deep heart of her smoke cloud, and getting ready to vanish, and now we closed the field glasses, and sat down on our steamer chairs contented and at peace. But they went to wreck, and ruin under us, and brought us to shame before all the passengers. They had been furnished by the largest furniture dealing house in Victoria, and were worth a couple of farthings a dozen, though they had cost us the price of honest chairs. In the Pacific and Indian Oceans one must still bring his own deck chair on board or go without, just as in the old forgotten Atlantic times those dark ages of sea travel. Ours was a reasonably comfortable ship, with the customary sea-going fare, plenty of good food furnished by the deity and cooked by the devil. The discipline observable on board was perhaps as good as it is anywhere in the Pacific and Indian Oceans. The ship was not very well arranged for tropical service, but that is nothing, for this is the rule for ships which ply in the tropics. S.E. had an oversupply of cockroaches, but this is also the rule with ships, doing business in the summer seas, at least such as have been long in service. Our young captain was a very handsome man, tall and perfectly formed, the very figure to show up a smart uniform's best effects. He was a man of the best intentions, and was polite and courteous even to courtliness. There was a soft and finish about his manners which made whatever place he happened to be in seem for the moment a drawing room. He avoided the smoking room. He had no vices. He did not smoke or chew tobacco or take snuff. He did not swear or use slang or rude or coarse or indelicate language or make puns or tell anecdotes or laugh intemperately, or raise his voice above the moderate pitch enjoined by the canons of good form. When he gave an order, his manner modified it into a request. After dinner he and his officers joined the ladies and gentlemen in the ladies' saloon, and shared in the singing and piano playing, and helped turn the music. He had a sweet and sympathetic tenor voice, and used it with taste and effect. The music he played whist there, always with the same partner and opponents, until the ladies' bedtime. The electric lights burned there as late as the ladies and their friends might desire, but they were not allowed to burn in the smoking room after 11. There were many laws on the ship's statute book, of course. But so far as I could see, this and one other were the only ones that were rigidly enforced. The captain explained that he enforced this one because his own cabin adjoined the smoking room, and the smell of tobacco smoke made him sick. I did not see how our smoke could reach him, for the smoking room and his cabin were on the upper deck, targets for all the winds that blew. And besides, there was no crack of communication between them, no opening of any sort in the solid intervening bulkhead. Still, to a delicate stomach, even imaginary smoke can convey damage. The captain, with his gentle nature, his polish, his sweetness, his moral and verbal purity, seemed pathetically out of place in his rude and autocratic vocation. It seemed another instance of the irony of fate. He was going home under a cloud. The passengers knew about his trouble, and were sorry for him. Approaching Vancouver through a narrow and difficult passage densely befogged with smoke from the forest fires, he had had the ill luck to lose his bearings, and get his ship on the rocks. A matter like this would rank merely as an error with you and me. It ranks as a crime with the directors of steamship companies. The captain had been tried by the Admiralty Court at Vancouver, and its verdict had acquitted him of blame. But that was insufficient comfort. A sterner court would examine the case in Sydney, the Court of Directors, the lords of a company in whose ships the captain had served as mate a number of years. This was his first voyage as captain. The officers of our ship were hearty and companionable young men, and they entered into the general amusements, and helped the passengers pass the time. Voyages in the Pacific and Indian Oceans are but pleasure excursions for all hands. Our purser was a young Scotchman who was equipped with a grit that was remarkable. He was an invalid, and looked it, as far as his body was concerned, but illness could not subdue his spirit. He was full of life, and had a gay and capable tongue. To all appearances he was a sick man without being aware of it, for he did not talk about his ailments, and his bearing and conduct were those of a person in robust health. Yet he was the prey, at intervals, of ghastly sieges of pain in his heart. These lasted many hours, and while the attack continued he could neither sit nor lie. In one instance he stood on his feet 24 hours fighting for his life with these sharp agonies, and yet was as full of life and cheer and activity the next day, as if nothing had happened. The brightest passenger in the ship, and the most interesting and felicitous talker, was a young Canadian who was not able to let the whiskey bottle alone. He was of a rich and powerful family, and could have had a distinguished career and abundance of effective help toward it, if he could have conquered his appetite for drink. But he could not do it, so his great equipment of talent was of no use to him. He had often taken the pledge to drink no more, and was a good sample of what that sort of unwisdom can do for a man with anything short of an iron will. The system is wrong in two ways. It does not strike at the root of the trouble, for one thing, and to make a pledge of any kind, is to declare war against nature, for a pledge is a chain, that is always clanking and reminding the wearer of it, that he is not a free man. I have said, that the system does not strike at the root of the trouble, and I venture to repeat that. The root is not the drinking, but the desire to drink. These are very different things. The one merely requires will and a great deal of it, both as to bulk and staying capacity. The other merely requires watchfulness and for no long time. The desire of course precedes the act, and should have one's first attention. It can do but little good to refuse the act over and over again, always leaving the desire unmolested, unconquered. The desire will continue to assert itself, and will be almost sure to win in the long run. When the desire intrudes, it should be at once banished out of the mind. One should be on the watch for it all the time, otherwise it will get in. It must be taken in time, and not allowed to get a lodgment. A desire constantly repulsed for a fortnight should die then. That should cure the drinking habit. The system of refusing the mere act of drinking, and leaving the desire in full force, is unintelligent war tactics, it seems to me. I used to take pledges and soon violate them. My will was not strong, and I could not help it. And then, to be tied in any way naturally irks an otherwise free person, and makes him chafe in his bonds and want to get his liberty. But when I finally ceased from taking definite pledges, and merely resolved that I would kill an injurious desire, but leave myself free to resume the desire and the habit whenever I should choose to do so, I had no more trouble. In 5 days I drove out the desire to smoke, and was not obliged to keep watch after that, and I never experienced any strong desire to smoke again. At the end of a year and a quarter of idleness I began to write a book, and presently found that the pen was strangely reluctant to go. I tried a smoke to see if that would help me out of the difficulty. It did. I smoked 8 or 10 cigars, and as many pipes a day for 5 months, finished the book, and did not smoke again until a year had gone by, and another book had to be begun. I can quit any of my 19 injurious habits at any time, and without discomfort or inconvenience. I think that the Dr. Tanners, and those others who go 40 days without eating, do it by resolutely keeping out the desire to eat, in the beginning, and that after a few hours the desire is discouraged, and comes no more. Once I tried my scheme in a large medical way. I had been confined to my bed several days with lumbago. My case refused to improve. Finally the doctor said, "My remedies have no fair chance. Consider what they have to fight, besides the lumbago. You smoke extravagantly, don't you?"
"Yes."
"You take coffee immoderately?"
"Yes."
"And some tea?"
"Yes."
"You eat all kinds of things that are dissatisfied with each other's company?"
"Yes."
"You drink 2 hot scotches every night?"
"Yes."
"Very well, there you see what I have to contend against. We can't make progress the way the matter stands. You must make a reduction in these things. You must cut down your consumption of them considerably for some days."
"I can't, doctor."
"Why can't you?"
"I lack the willpower.
I can cut them off entirely, but I can't merely moderate them." He said that that would answer, and said he would come around in 24 hours, and begin work again. He was taken ill himself, and could not come, but I did not need him. I cut off all those things for 2 days and nights. In fact, I cut off all kinds of food too, and all drinks except water, and at the end of the 48 hours the lumbago was discouraged and left me. I was a well man. So I gave thanks, and took to those delicacies again. It seemed a valuable medical course, and I recommended it to a lady. She had run down and down and down, and had at last reached a point where medicines no longer had any helpful effect upon her. I said I knew I could put her upon her feet in a week. It brightened her up, it filled her with hope, and she said she would do everything I told her to do. So I said she must stop swearing and drinking, and smoking and eating for 4 days, and then she would be all right again. And it would have happened just so, I know it. But she said she could not stop swearing, and smoking, and drinking, because S.E. had never done those things. So there it was. S.E. had neglected her habits, and hadn't any. Now that they would have come good, there were none in stock. S.E. had nothing to fall back on. She was a sinking vessel, with no freight in her to throw over lighten ship with Al. Why, even 1 or 2 little bad habits could have saved her, but she was just a moral pauper. When she could have acquired them, she was dissuaded by her parents, who were ignorant people, though reared in the best society, and it was too late to begin now. It seemed such a pity, but there was no help for it. These things ought to be attended to while a person is young. Otherwise, when age and disease come, there is nothing effectual to fight them with. When I was a youth I used to take all kinds of pledges, and do my best to keep them, but I never could, because I didn't strike at the root of the habit, the desire. I generally broke down within a month. Once I tried limiting a habit. That worked tolerably well for a while. I pledged myself to smoke but 1 cigar a day. I kept the cigar waiting until bedtime, then I had a luxurious time with it. But desire persecuted me every day and all day long, So, within a week I found myself hunting for larger cigars than I had been used to smoke, then larger ones still, and still larger ones. Within a fortnight I was getting cigars made for me on a yet larger pattern. They still grew and grew in size. Within a month my cigar had grown to such proportions that I could have used it as a crutch. It now seemed to me that a one cigar limit was no real protection to a person, so I knocked my pledge on the head and resumed my liberty. To go back to that young Canadian. He was a admittance man, the first one I had ever seen or heard of. Passengers explained the term to me. They said that dissipated ne'er-do-wells belonging to important families in England and Canada were not cast off by their people, while there was any hope of reforming them, but when that last hope perished at last, the ne'er-do-well was sent abroad, to get him out of the way. He was shipped off with just enough money in his pocket, no, in the purser's pocket for the needs of the voyage, and when he reached his destined port he would find a remittance awaiting him there. Not a large one, but just enough to keep him a month. A similar remittance would come monthly thereafter. It was the remittance man's custom to pay his month's board and lodging straightway, a duty which his landlord did not allow him to forget, then spree away the rest of his money in a single night, then brood and mope and grieve in idleness till the next remittance came. It is a pathetic life. We had other remittance men on board, it was said. At least they said they were RMS, there were two. But they did not resemble the Canadian. They lacked his tidiness, and his brains, and his gentlemanly ways, and his resolute spirit, and his humanities and generosities. One of them was a lad of 19 or 20, and he was a good deal of a ruin, as to clothes, and morals, and general aspect. He said he was a scion of a ducal house in England, and had been shipped to Canada for the house's relief, that he had fallen into trouble there, and was now being shipped to Australia. He said he had no title. Beyond this remark he was economical of the truth. The first thing he did in Australia was to get into the lockup, and the next thing he did was to proclaim himself an earl in the police court in the morning, and fail to prove it. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.